I don't like the idea of that we have to give away in order to get something, that you shouldn't have to give yourself away in order to get love. And I think that's the narrative that has to change with young girls, is that you're giving this man something. And so my, you know, as I got older, I'm like, well, I want it back.
I'm Sonia Statman, and you're listening to The Feminine Lens. Over the last 20 years, I've had the honor to work with thousands of women around the globe in self-development, in leadership, and in business. Being in the trenches with women has taught me that we have to stop seeing ourselves and the world through the patriarchal lens. I've spent my life helping women look through a new lens, a feminine lens, a lens that honors our innate worth and wisdom, a lens that empowers us with more wealth and freedom. The Feminine Lens is designed to challenge you. It will change what you think and what you know, but it will help you reclaim yourself. And that is the way we change the world. Ready? Let's do this. Welcome back to The Feminine Lens. I have a beautiful and wonderful special guest today. Her name is Jessica Care Moore. She's the founder and CEO of More Black Press, executive producer of Black Women Rock, and founder of the literacy-driven Jess Care Moore Foundation. She's an internationally renowned poet, playwright, performance artist, and producer. She's amazing. And she's written so many books: The Words Don't Fit in My Mouth, The Alphabet Versus the Ghetto, Sunlight Through Bullet Holes, and she has a new book called We Want Our Bodies Back. So welcome, Jessica. I'm so glad to have you here today.
Thank you. And do you pronounce, is it Sonia or Sonia?
You know what? I say Sonia, but you can say Sonia. So many people do.
It looks like Sonia to me. Thank you for having me, Sonia. I'm really excited, especially because we're talking about the feminine lens, which I really appreciate that perspective.
Yeah, look, me too. And, you know, I think it's just going to be a really powerful conversation. So where I love to start is just first tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, obviously you are a force. You have done so much with your voice for change. What kind of started you on this journey?
Wow. You know, I mean, I've always been a whippersnapper, you know, even as a little girl growing up in a place called Detroit, Michigan. I was very dreamy and I was very interested in, I think I wanted to save the planet very early. And I started with animals, I had like this obsession with animals. I had brothers, oh my God, brothers suck, right? Because brothers want to shoot the squirrels with BB guns. And I'm like, no, you can't kill the BB guns, squirrels. And, you know, so I was always that. So I started with animals and you know, I grew up on a beautiful block in Detroit, you know, because people think about Detroit, they don't quite get it. You know, I grew up at really beautiful childhood growing up in Detroit, house full of kids and definitely a block full of kids. We played outside till the streetlights went down. We rode our bikes everywhere without helmets.
Yeah, sounds amazing.
We survived great things like this. And for me, you know, I've always been, my father, Tom Moore, you know, would have been, I think, 96 this year, much older than my mother. So I grew up with this very vibrant, very male energy in my house. Mm. House very patriarchal. I had brothers and daddy. And that also shaped me as well, right, into the woman that I am. But because of that, you know, I became strong and rebellious, I think, very early. I wasn't really a fighter, but I went to predominantly white Catholic schools from first through eighth grade. And so I was one of like four or five Black kids in my classroom until I got to high school, where I went to a predominantly Black school, and then everything kind of changed. But that also informed me. What it did during those Catholic school years was kept me quiet. And so I internalized a lot and I wrote a lot. And it definitely shaped the lens of how I looked at the world. Because you know, my block and my house were one way, but school was very different. On my block, I was loud. I was so loud. If anyone said that I was quiet, nobody in my family thinks I was ever quiet. But in school, I was. Because when you're the Black girl, one of the two or three Black girls in the classroom, you know, you never get to be the prettiest. You're not the ones that the boys, you know, it's just you never get to be any of the things. You just are the other. And I made a joke earlier today. I was on an interview and I said, yeah, none of the white boys told me I was pretty in school until we got on Facebook. and I'm like,
then it changed.
Oh, of course. I mean, they always thought it, but you know, because of the way the world is, right? Children, unfortunately, are affected. I have a 14-year-old son affected by the outside world. So if I could have just, you know, the world in my house, my dad, my mom, and my family, if that was the world, then I would have never had any issues with race and sexism. I was protected by my brothers and got to be my full self and have my big, strong, big mouth. But in other settings, you feel like you have to be quiet. And this is the place where you're celebrated even talked about inside of books. There's no one that looks like you in any of these books, the Bible books, the history books, the literature books. There's no one that looks like you that writes poetry. It took me to high school to know that poets look like me. My mother, though, I have to shout out my mother, who ate books when I was a little girl and read lots of memoir and fiction and absolutely gave me Lorraine Hansberry to be on Gifted in Black, absolutely gave me Alice Walker and Maya Angelou. So she saw that I was an early reader. I was a speed reader. She reads books fast. I used to read books faster than I can now, but I was a real good reader and very advanced as a reader, which developed me into the writer that I am now. You know, just I wanted to read everything and not so much fiction. I was very interested in the truth. So I wanted to, my mother's like, I want memoir. I want people's stories. I want to hear people's stories and I want to hear history. I was very a history. I wanted to know how we got here. So that's kind of what shaped me, you know, growing up in a very, very Midwest. And I live here now. I moved away for a long time. I was in New York. At 22, I moved to New York, moved to Brooklyn, and life changed very fast there. And I became a full-time artist. But before that, you know, I was here and I'm back in Detroit. I'm in historic Boston Edison, beautiful Black neighborhood. It's very, very more mixed than it used to be back in the day. So because we have new white people that have moved in, so we have white neighbors that have been here for like 6 years or eight, and then have Black people who've been here 30 and 40 and 50 years.
That's amazing.
So it's pretty dope, you know what I mean? So, and I like all of it. Like I enjoy all of it. As long as people are talking to each other, then we can build community. And yeah, so I'm here in the D.
I love it. And I think, you know, one of the things you said, which I find is so interesting. So I talk a lot about reclaiming our voices because I feel like as women, we have been very suppressed in so many ways. And I think it's so interesting because, you know, talking about kind of the intersection of things, you were in a Catholic school that, you know, is very kind of suppressive in terms of voice, a woman, very suppressive, you know, and then of course a Black woman. So then there's all these really interesting.
Let me say this. The white girls were loud.
Were they?
Absolutely. Lisa Murkowski, Elizabeth, Jackie Meester, they were free, loud, white girls. Yeah. I mean, they were the cool ones.
Yeah.
That's, you know, absolutely. It wasn't, so it wasn't that girls couldn't be loud because, I mean, we always had the playground, we had parties. So they, I felt like were able to be their full selves. It's just, and you're in the environment where you're not the majority. I mean, I can remember, it was like Sansire, Roderick, you know, I can count like the kids that, Black in my class, and some of them they lived in my neighborhood. I grew up in Detroit on the border of Dearborn, which Dearborn, Michigan has the largest population of Arab people in the world outside the Middle East live in the border of Detroit, which is Dearborn. I lived right on that border. And so in Dearborn, there was Arab population, Muslim and Catholic, and Polish kids. So I went to school, a lot of white Polish kids who secretly liked the Arab boys, but they couldn't say they liked them. You know, it's just all this stuff with, you know, so suppressed in some ways.
Yeah.
But in classrooms and things like that, they ruled.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, that was such a different experience for me. But, you know, and I think that that's the interesting part is it's really always looking at what is the individual experience, right? So last month I was working with a lot of my clients and we did the topic of reclaiming our voices. What does that look like? What does that feel like? And it was amazing how many of them, and it probably is because many of my clients are more introverted. They're, you know, not like super loud anyway, but so many of them experience that suppression of their voice from their fathers, from the men in their lives, so it's this really interesting path. And so, you know, I always like to look at like, what is the path back to reclaiming our voices? And I think that's really interesting. I would love to hear your viewpoint on that. And in addition, you know, reclaiming our bodies, right? Because that really is the title and focus of your book, which is We Want Our Bodies Back. How do we reclaim our voices and our bodies when we've been suppressed in some way?
Well, I guess mine started with my mother left my father, which broke my heart. But because of that, she was now becoming a single parent. And she had me and my sister left in the house. My brothers had moved on. One went to Army and one was living on his own. And she couldn't afford private school anymore. So we had to go to public school for the first time. And that was very scary for me, but it was like the best thing that ever happened to my life. And Detroit, so shout out to Frank Cody High School for saving this little brown girl, because even though I was weird, I was an awkward Black girl going into that situation. You know, you talk like a white girl, had very proper English. And, you know, I just know how to get to the end of a damn sentence, but that was looked down upon. And the only thing that really saved me, that truly saved me in Detroit, in Detroit public schools, were two things. One is I became a 4 varsity letterman. So, but at the white school, right, at St. Alphonsus, I didn't make the basketball team. And so I thought I couldn't play basketball. And I knew I could play, but I learned how to play basketball in the backyard with my brothers. So my crossover wasn't, and I talk about it in my book, my crossover was different. My crossover had some flavor. It was some Allen Iverson. You know, they didn't know what to do with me. And so I thought I couldn't play. So I became a cheerleader, and I hate cheerleaders. And I really was just mad that I couldn't get on the basketball team. I went into Cody High School my freshman year at 13 years old, and I made varsity. And I was like, what just happened? Just so the way I came down the court wasn't foreign to these Black coaches, and they could see my potential. And I made varsity freshman year when I thought I couldn't even play. I'd been convinced that I wasn't a good basketball player. Then I made the softball team. Then I played the volleyball team. Then I ran cross country. And then there was this beautiful thing called a Black box theater inside of my high school. And my drama teacher, Susan Story, brought For Color Girls by Ntozake Shange, the play, into the Black Box Theater. And I was a nerd. I was an athlete, but really I was a nerd. And so I was in the drama club, of course. So learning theater, we did like, you know, Grease and To Kill a Mockingbird and, you know, all these musicals, West Side Story. I was in all those things. But For Color Girls, whoa. I mean, that language and the way Ntozake wrote, I was writing poetry at that time, but that's what woke me up. My whole life trajectory really is from that moment, it changed. And I realized that there were women who wrote for me. There were women poets who were waiting for me. And I have now become one of those women that writes for other girls and waits for them to find them, you know? And that's that kind of a magical thing that just made me stop being quiet in all spaces. So there was a time when white spaces, like my predominantly white Catholic school, silenced me. They didn't do it, but I made myself quiet in those spaces. And then after that, after I realized that I wasn't by myself, and there were Black women like Sonia Sanchez and Lucille Clifton and Audre Lorde, Mari Evans, Jane Cortez. Oh my God. I mean, it's countless. Alice Walker that were out here like fighting and pushing Black liberation and freedom through this thing called poetry. And that I wasn't by myself, that I had other mothers. That woke me up and I stopped being afraid. And I used my articulate voice to my advantage and got on some microphones and later on in college and started, you know, I became an activist. I was an activist first, you know. I really wanted to change the world. I really did. In Michigan State, Wayne State University, I was a journalism, political science major, but I had this heavy voice, but so that's another problem. So when I was at the predominantly white Catholic school, my voice was heavy when I was little. Jackie Meester, who was in my class, I wonder where Jackie is, I have no idea. But I remember her because she also had a very kind of deep, raspy voice like mine. I was always scared to raise my hand. I never wanted to read out loud because of the way my voice sounded. I was embarrassed. And then years later, here I am. The one thing that I got to my advantage is that when I get on a microphone with all these male hip hop MCs, rappers, poets, my voice carries through that mic. I can get on that mic and I got this deepness in my voice. Similar, like Alicia Keys got it. That same, that resonance inside your voice where you talk and I can get people's attention. And I realized my voice was powerful. You know, even just sonically powerful in a way that some girls didn't have those kind of voices. And so when you're little, that voice is heavy. When you're older, it's strength.
Yeah. And so. It's amazing. And I think, you know, it sounds like you're really creating a space for people to resonate with your experiences, to feel like, I mean, I love how you said it, that when you finally felt you weren't alone, or when you realized there were people like you, there were leaders like you, there were people, you know, in those spaces doing that activism and doing that big work, that's when things really shifted for you. And I think, you know, recognizing that we need those resonant spaces. And that feels like what you're creating with your books and your poetry and everything that you're doing. You're creating a space for people to recognize that they're not alone. They have a voice. They have, you know, people in their community like them.
Yeah, and young girls need to know that, you know, especially. So Black Women Rock, you know, that's a rock and roll thing I do. And I asked you about Jackie Vinson because I brought her to Detroit I can't even count how many times now, how much I love Jackie Vinson. So shout out to Austin. You got a real one in your city that could take that guitar and quiet down a room and bring the room all the way back up. And she's amazing, but you know, not enough people know who she is. And she's traveled all over the world and all over this country. And so Black on the Rock was a space where I saw, I was in New York City. I was on the rock and roll scene and in the poetry scene at the same time. I was trying to find more ways to connect my poetry to bigger audiences. And poetry scene was just, for me, was too limiting. The cafes are too small. I was like, I want more people. I want 300 people. I want 500 people. I need some people. And I want to do it in the audience. You know, I wanted to touch a lot of people. And music is a way that you transcend the way you get to those bigger audiences. So music became this space. I got to find a space. And I'm not the first poet to work with music. It goes Sky Heron. You know, my master teacher, the last poets, you know, the Watts Prophets. I mean, this is not new. Nikki Giovanni worked with orchestra. Sonia Sanchez has albums out. Jane Cortez and the Fire Spitters. Like, I come from a tradition of poets that also work with music. Amiri Baraka always worked with jazz. And so I wanted to do, you know, I'm very Patti Smith with it. You know, I really wanted to jump around on the stage and do my poems and talk about revolution. And I was able to do that. Do bigger spaces and not being afraid. And Black on the Rock was born because I knew all these women that did that. I was in awe of them. Tim Akali and Imani Azuri, Divinity Rocks, Yazara. I mean, I was watching these women control these stages and I was like, look at these Black women playing this rock and roll. And I knew that rock and roll was created by Black women. I know that rock and roll was the blues sped up, but I went to school with white, I listened to Led Zeppelin, AC/DC. Van Halen, honey, listen, I was listening to Rick Springfield singing Jesse's Girl, you know, just, I was on one. I knew Metallica, like I knew all of that. I mean, I knew Jimi Hendrix and I knew Tina Turner and Grace Jones too, right?
Yeah.
But I came immersed in this thing. So I was producing, left New York and went to Atlanta in 2000, producing for the National Black Arts Festival, became a young producer. And I wanted to bring a rock and roll concert to the National Black Arts Festival, which was much more literary and theater driven. And I wanted to be all Black women that played rock and roll. And I wanted to show people that this was a thing. You know, shout out to Black Rock Coalition that has been doing that for a long time, but I just wanted mine to be all women.
Yes.
And so I did the first concert in 2004. And here we are 16 years later, we've done it all over the country. It's annual normally in Detroit. And we support and amplify the voices of Black women in rock and roll, the history of Black women in rock and roll, but also giving them space because urban radio doesn't play their music and white rock stations don't play their music. So they're stuck in like this strange purgatory of no support for their voices. And some of them have traveled, and me included, all over the world. But still, there's festivals that don't invite me. I've performed all over South Africa, South America, London. There's still some literary festivals that never call Jessica Gilmore for a gig. and they may never. And that's just what it is. And so we have to break through segregated arts festivals, segregated libraries, segregated bookstores. These things all exist. And I have the energy and the wherewithal to push through. I don't know why, but I can't help myself. And I've been asked, you know, on different interviews, like, how do you do it? Or how do you have the energy? And I don't know. I'm from an institution building city. I'm from a city where I wasn't told because you're Black, you can't have. I was told because you're Black, you can have. Because you're Black, you're excellent. I was raised that way. I wasn't raised that because you're Black, you're minority. Because you're Black, no, you run the planet. I'm a Coleman A. Young baby. You may not know who Mayor Coleman Young is, but from 1994 to 1973 to 1994, he was the mayor of Detroit. That's literally my entire adult, like that's me being born into like leaving for New York the next year. That's all I knew, that we had a rowdy, crazy, phenomenal, shit-talking mayor, super Black like my father. And I also grew up with like Black City Council and police officers, people that look like me in different spaces, lawyers. I saw all those things. And so, you know, I was never limited in my thinking. I just thought the world was limited.
Yes.
And that we have to find a way to like push past these things that keep the others out, so that, you know, folks can shine. And so, yeah, I did that. I did that with Black on the Rock for sure. And then through more Black press with my publishing house in 1997. I do that work very naturally. It gives me joy. Like, I love seeing other people Like if you came to a Black Women Rock concert and you looking at Nick West with her bass or Divinity Rocks or any of these women, I mean, from Jackie Benson, whoever comes, Dion Ferris, Julie Dexter, Liza Kobe. I mean, there's so many. Nona Hendrix, the legend, has done our show several times. And it makes me joy just watching you watch them.
I love it.
You know, like, look at them. So, I mean, it's a part of my DNA to, like, I want to amplify voices. And somebody looked out for my voice. I'm not here just because no one helped me. And so I think that it's what we're supposed to do.
Absolutely.
So thank you for having me on your show, because this is how we create. That's, you know, whatever your listeners are that never heard of me, now get to know about me and know about my work as poet and activist and as a woman. But they may only know like two or three Black girls that they show on mainstream television that do this work. And there's a whole bunch of us.
No, I love it. It's an absolute honor. And speaking of that, I want to get a little bit into your book, and I would love to as well hear one of your poems, if you would grace us with that. And in your book, like, one of the things that really stood out to me, I was reading the introduction, and you said this thing of, you know, when you decide to give your body to someone, what in fact do you receive in exchange? If we in fact do choose to give up our bodies, when do we have them back? I thought that was such a powerful line. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, it's deep. So, you know, you grow up as a little girl, and the whole thing about like giving up your virginity has always been interesting to me.
Me too.
And I feel like, you know, girls are told you have to give something up. Just with your first sexual experience, you got to give somebody something. And because I've been a mentor with young girls in schools now, you know, I'm always talking to them about like their bodies, and their bodies are temples. I teach my son, though, the same thing at 14, that his body is also a temple. And so I don't like the idea of that we have to give away in order to get something, that you shouldn't have to give yourself away in order to get love. And I think that's the narrative that has to change with young girls, is that you're giving this man something. And so my, you know, as I got older, I'm like, well, I want it back, you know? And I actually have a rock song. I'm working on a rock and roll project right now, Coffee is a Drug. And something I said earlier, which is the truth. And it's saying like, you know, one day I want to take my loving back from you. Coffee is a drug, so I drink it black. One day I'm going to take all my love. And I'm saying loving because we're on the show. But, you know, it's like wanting to take your physical body back. And there's like, people that, you know, I'm a grown up, I've been married twice, and men that I've dated. And like, you think about those moments, those silly decisions you made with some person, man or woman, whoever you date, right? And you just like, God, if I could just take my body back from that place, or take my body back from this space that I put myself in that's not healthy. It doesn't have to be physical space. Just sometimes we're just in really bad spiritual spaces, right? How do you remove yourself? And it took me some work. I've been divorced twice. And I've been single for many years, and dating and single and in control of my life in such a way that I feel much more whole as a woman, and less in a shadow of having to like be quiet and dim my light to feed an ego. And so I just refuse to do that anymore. Like, I won't be with a man. I would prefer to be well on my own and as loud as I want and wear my skirts as short as I feel like it, and be my full self, than to have to quiet it down and hope that he isn't feeling insecure today. I just can't do that dance. And I know women who do it. I see them quietly disappearing inside their marriages and becoming someone's wife and forgetting that they were a woman and forgetting they were something other than just a mom. You know, I love my son. I have my son Omari is 25. I have an earth son that I raised in my first marriage. And my son King is 14. I've had stepchildren that I love very much. But, you know, I take my mommy breaks without guilt. And because sometimes I just need to take care of Jessica. And women are not taught that. We have to give. I'm a natural nurturer too. So I'm a giver. So I have to make myself not give to everybody so that I can have something left for myself. Yeah.
So important. Look, I mean, I constantly work with over-deliverers and over-owners and over-givers. And I think, you know, that touched me so much, that particular line, because I do feel when we're young, we're not taught to be in charge of our own bodies, to be empowered in our own bodies. And then, you know, I also thought about for those who didn't choose, right? Like, I was raped at 15. So, you know, that experience, really, I didn't choose to give up my body, but no one taught me how to take it back, right? No one taught me how to claim it again.
how do you heal?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And how do you figure that? And you know, that story, I mean, that story is all my girls.
Yeah.
I talked to my girls once when I found out one of my girls had been molested by someone in her family. And so I decided, okay, let's have this conversation. It wasn't one in three, Sonya. It was every single one of them.
Me too.
Had a story. It broke my heart. All of them. And so what is the healing work that has to happen? So you love yourselves more than you love this person who thinks they can take from you. Because they can't, because they, that person didn't take it from you. They did, but they can't have it.
That's right.
They don't get to you. And that's what the poem, even We Want Our Bodies Back, is saying. It's saying, you can't have it. It's mine. You can't have it. You can't make decisions about it. You can't touch it. You can't talk to it. It's mine. I will kiss my own damn self. Look, I took a shower the other night. I was kissing on my arms. It's the pandemic. I don't have a, you know, in-house boyfriend. And yeah. So I had to like make sure I'm loving on myself. Let me kiss my shoulders. You know, what can I reach? Make sure I'm making sure you even taking those baths. You know, I mean, my baths are serious. My sister Sabrina Nelson is a painter. She's got rose petals and she's got the incense and the candles. Like, we take our baths so seriously. I'm blessed to have a bathtub, like an old school bathtub. If you have a bathtub, you use, I'm telling you, because I'm telling myself, is to get in the damn thing.
Every day.
Good for you. I can do it every day. Tonight, after this podcast tour, it's going down. And so, but you know, but nobody gives us the tools, right?
That's
as
right.
young women to say, this is the way that you get out of this. This is the way that you survive. And poetry has been my way. That's been my outlet, my way of getting out. In the intro, I also talk about the ugly piece of shit that used to come to my house to do the lawn care that did it's a spider up my dress. I think I'm saying I'm five. I might have been four. I remember it.
Yeah.
I'll never forget it. I know how his hands felt. And I was smart enough at that age to know that this is not right. Something about his hands on me felt so wrong. And I ran to my godmother. And to this day, I think my father killed him. I don't know. He never came back. I'm like, did my daddy kill that man? Like, what? The long guy, he just disappeared. But that was happened to be in the backyard. And then, you know, this little itsy bitsy, you know, may he burn in hell forever. And thank God it didn't go past that. Because, you know, how do I recover it at 4 or 5 years old? And
that's right.
There are little girls who get raped at that age. And so he's disgusting. And that, but the fact that that stayed with me, that it's, this is my fifth book and I'm in my 40s. I'm writing about it.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to like negotiate it. I'm still trying to be okay. Right. Yeah. With that moment that like, cause you can't take the moments back. You can only find ways to filter it and push it in other places. You got to cry about it. You got to talk about it. You got to write about it, but you can't suppress it.
That's right. You know? And I think it's so interesting as well, because you know, we're not supported in that, right? Like as things happen to us, we're taught in so many different ways that we need to like handle it. It's our burden to bear, even though we had no control in the experience of it. And I think, you know, like I know for I have two daughters, a 6-year-old and an 18-year-old, and I have taught them, you know, their bodies are their own. They have control over it. Like, you know, all of the things that I feel like I was never told. Like I was never taught. I never felt protected. I never felt like I could share with someone, you know, what had happened to me, all the many things. I mean, there was the rape, of course, but there was so many other things, right? Ways men touched me, ways men looked at me, ways men pressured me, right? Like, you know, it's a constant thing. And we're expected to hold the burden of it. And, you know, for me, I didn't even acknowledge that it was a full rape until a couple years ago in my TEDx talk. Like that was the period of working on that and expressing it publicly was the first time I ever actually told anyone that I was like actually raped. I owned it as like, oh, it was my problem. It was more of a date rape. Like it was my fault. I shouldn't have been in that situation.
Date rapes have happened to so many of my
friends.
And they never tell anybody. They never press charges. They don't tell anybody.
That's
they blame
right.
themselves. If they have one glass of wine, they don't tell, you know, because women become, it was our fault. Even someone asked me, like, I think today during an interview asked me about, do you think that it's something that Black girls are doing with their bodies or something to make them more open to being assaulted? And I was like,
who said that?
Somebody. Definitely was a man. I was like, no, I'm going to just say no to that.
Oh my God.
Absolutely not. Are you out of your mind? Like, of course not. It's not our fault that our bodies are our bodies,
That's
you know,
right.
and And if, you know, it's deep is because there was a long time when I was coming up in Detroit, I was on the hip hop scene and I was a poet. I would wear clothes that were like 2 times bigger than what I, if you ask people back in the 90s, they didn't know what my body looked like because I purposely wore big jeans, big old t-shirts. It was the hip hop style, but it was a way for me to cover up my body so that the guys would be focused on what I was saying. And then there was a shift in New York City. I switched it up and I was like, you know what? I'm not hiding. I'm going to put on a tight ass dress and put on these damn stilettos. I'm going to do my poems like that. And I show off my people know I show off my poetry readings just like that. I got my heels. Sometimes I may not feel like it, but if I feel like it, I'm out of my fly hat, my heels, my dress, and y'all going to have to focus and be grow up because this is my body and I have the right to wear what the hell I want to wear when I'm reading my poems.
You have the right to wear what the hell you want any time of any day, 24/7.
Exactly. Come on. Yeah. But they blame women, the slut shaming and all the things that go on with her. Well, she was wearing this. Well, yeah, she was wearing that. There's nothing a man that is wearing, as good as he may look in it, that makes me want to rape him.
Yeah. Well, like, it's as if we should excuse men for their lack of control. Right. And that we should alter ourselves. And we do this in so many ways. Right. We alter ourselves for men. We alter ourselves for the men in our lives. Like, you know, I always use this example because I think it's really funny of like what happens in our kitchen. When my husband's in the kitchen, he needs all the space and all the women are working around him. Right. The 18-year-old, the 6-year-old, we're trying not to get in his way. Right. In so many ways, we're making space for him because he requires more than we do. And this is the way we treat men. Right. So automatic.
We just balance the babies out of our head and cook the meal, honey, listen, and then blow you a kiss and do all the things. Like
100%.
Wow.
Well, look, I would really love, as we're wrapping up this interview, I'd really love to hear you read one of your poems.
And I'm going to read kind of a fun poem because we talked about me and growing up in Detroit.
Yeah.
I might put on my old lady glasses since it's on audio. Great.
Okay, fantastic.
Yes, no judgment on my oldness. Anyways, I used to, which is another thing we can talk about, like this whole thing. It's just so funny to me because men don't get old, just us.
Yeah.
It's like, yo, they can have pop bellies, they can be whatever. Yep. And we gotta hold all this shit together forever. Like, get out of here. So I'm so adult. So this is called I Used to Be a Roller Coaster Girl. And I like that we're talking about, you know, young women and being girls. And I wrote this Intozake Shange. I actually had the privilege of having some time with her before she passed away a few years ago in Florida at the Maroon Festival, Literary Festival. I was at honoring her and other poets. And I love Intozake so much, man. She reminded me of myself because she was wild and crazy and in love. She was in love all the time and talking a lot of shit. And I loved her for it. But this is called I Used to Be a Roller Coaster Girl. And I said that to Intozake. I said, Intozake, I used to be a roller coaster girl. So it's about growing up in Detroit. I used to be a roller coaster girl. 7 times in a row, no vertical in these skinny legs. My lipstick bubblegum pink as my Panther 10 speed, never kiss. Nappy pigtails, no brand gym shoes, white line yellow short shorts, scratched up legs pedaling past borders of hummus and baba ganoush, masjids and liquor stores, city chicken, pepperoni bread, and Superman ice cream cones, yellow black blending with bits of Arabic, Islam, and Catholicism. My daddy was Jesus. My mother was quiet. Jane Kennedy was worshipped by my brother Mark. I don't remember having my own bed before 12. Me and my sister Lisa shared. Sometimes all 3 more girls slept in that queen. You grow up so close, never close enough. I used to be a roller coaster girl, wild child full of flowers and ideas, useless crushes on Polish boys in a school full of white girls, future black swan singing Zeppelin, U2, and Rick Springfield, hoping to be Jesse's girl. I could outrun my brothers and everybody else to that recurring line. I used to be a roller coaster girl. Till you told me I was moving too fast, said my rush made your head spin, my laughter hurt your ears, a scream of happiness, a scream of freedom pouring out my armpits, sweating up my neck. You were always the scared one. I kept my eyes open for the entire trip. Right before the drop, I would brace myself and let that force push my head back into that hard iron seat. My arms nearly fell off a few times till I kept running back to the line when I was done. Same way I kept running back to you. I used to be a roller coaster girl. I wasn't scared of mountains or falling. Hell, I look forward to flying and dropping out this earth and coming back to life every once in a while. I found some peace in being out of control, allowing my blood to race through my veins for 180 seconds. I earn my sometimes nicotine pull. I buy my own damn drinks, and the ocean still calls my name when it feels my toes near its shore. I still love roller coasters. And you grew up to be afraid of all girls who could ride fearlessly like me. So that's for little girls, man. You know, like keep riding roller coasters. Just keep riding roller coasters.
Well, and I think it's for adult women as well, right? Because our little girls stopped riding roller coasters, right?
Yes. And it's for me. It was me for a reminder of my childhood fearlessness that sometimes is not always there. When I became a mother, I became scared of roller coasters. And I don't like them now. I ride them now because I have no choice. And sometimes I've gone to like Disney and stuff like that with my son, and I have no choice because I can't let him in the line. He's like, "Mommy, I want to go on all the stuff that goes in five different upside down things." And I'm looking at him like, "Dude, do you know that I'm really not this young? I'm not really here for this." But King doesn't care. He's like, "Yo, you're coming." And so I'm my son's friend, you know, so I have to do it. But yeah, I have to remind myself of sometimes of who I was, you know, especially with motherhood. Motherhood is a whole nother thing.
Motherhood, but
you
get kind of swallowed up.
It's a whole nother podcast.
Look, that was a beautiful poem. This was an amazing interview. Like, I'm so thankful that you came on to my show. So how can people find you?
Oh, please come follow me on Instagram, please. Jessica Care More on everything. If you go to jessicacaremore.com, they can get my music. They can get vinyl and my other books that I published before We Want Our Bodies Back. We Want Our Bodies Back is everywhere. It's on HarperCollins, Amistad. So it's anywhere books are sold. And I hope to get to Austin. I want to say that out loud. So yes. If somebody's listening and you're a promoter, like, I want to come with my band to Austin. I want to rock in Austin. 21, I hope it can happen. And maybe we can bring Black Women Rock. If you people go to blackwomenrock.com, that's why you can find some of the women that I work with and see the movement that's been happening for 16 years. And so just thank you so much. This has been really beautiful.
Yeah.
And not like interviews. So I appreciate it.
Okay, good. I'm so glad. No, thank you. And we'll make sure to have all of those things in the show notes so that everybody can find you. Thank you, everyone. And we will see you next week. Thanks so much for listening to The Feminine Lens. If you're a woman in business and tired of trying to operate through the traditional patriarchal lens, check out my group program. You get the chance to apply these podcast topics to your life and business. You'll find coaching, support, and new perspectives on how to grow your business with more alignment and freedom. You'll be surrounded by amazing women and transform the way you feel about your value, your voice, and the gift you are bringing to the world. Just head over to SonjaStatman.com. All right, see you next week.